Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Thursday. It's August 5th, 57 degrees here in Old Town Park City. Some smoky skies. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center meteorologist, Cesar Cornejo. Good morning.
Good morning. We continue to see, yes, all of that smoky sky still continue for us as we have flows, airflow from the west and northwest, and that'll continue into today and later on tonight. We do expect to see the possibility of some light chances of thunderstorms possible. Once again, nothing too heavy pouring, but again, just keep that in mind. Lightning is probable with some of these storms. We'll see a high of 86 today and a low of 64 our overnight lows. And Friday, we're expecting to see that we have the possibility of some lingering moisture. Not going to see much else. It's going to be very isolated and spotty in nature. And we'll see smoke still hang around. Unfortunately, the cold front does not clear it out as much as we'd like. We'll see a high of 75. And going into Friday night, we continue with the patchy smoke, and we'll see that we have a low of 52. Saturday, we expect to see a high of 78 with plenty of sunshine as high pressure controls our area. And we'll see patchy smoke still making its way in. Once again, Saturday night, the smoke will continue for us just on the more or less light side with mostly clear skies, a low of 56. Sunday, we see sunny skies and the probability of some smoke still hanging around. We'll see a high of 84 as we continue to increase in our temperatures. Sunday night, mostly clear skies. We'll see a low of 58. Monday, we're expecting to see that we have a high of 81 with plenty of sunshine. Once again, still high pressure holding on tight to our area. So we expect to see that we have those clear conditions continuing to Monday night also with a low of 56. Tuesday, we continue to see the return of some moisture, but not going to see much in the activity of thunderstorms as we only have a slight chance. Plenty of sunshine still hanging around for us with a high of 80. Tuesday night, we can expect to see, again, that thunderstorm chance slowly wane out as we go into the overnight hours, mostly clear skies, with a low of 56. Wednesday, we continue to see that possibility of some light rain for very few areas, and again, mostly sunny skies, with a high of 81 for us. From the Pinpoint Weather Center, I'm meteorologist Cesar Cornejo. Over to you, Leslie.
Okay, thanks, Cesar. KPCW News Time now, 8:08. Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Heber City Council member Heidi Franco. She's got an update on this week's meeting, including passage of the Clean Air Ordinance and a proposed property tax increase. Summit County Council member Doug Clyde recapping yesterday's meeting, including the consolidation of the clerk and auditor positions, a discussion on Highland Flats, and the possible amendments to the Eastern Summit County Development Code regulating private campgrounds and seasonal RV use. Finally, Summit County Library Director Dan Compton with an update on some of their library programs, including expanding the hours at the Colville Library. The Heber City Council met on Tuesday, and on the phone with a meeting recap, I have Council Member Heidi Franco. Good morning, Heidi.
Good morning, everyone. Good morning, Leslie.
First up, something you've worked hard on over these past several months, the air quality ordinance, which the council finally approved. So does it have all of the elements that you were hoping for?
Yes, it does. Actually, Leslie, I've been working on this for about 8 years now and talking about these ideas for quite some time. And I'm so excited that our city is being proactive this way in mostly a voluntary education-based outreach air quality ordinance. So would you like to dive into the details, or what do you think?
Well, maybe just to what extent does the ordinance bring any new legal requirements versus just being kind of an official document that is meant to encourage good practices?
There are good practices. Yes, there are, for the anti-idling and radon mitigation and so forth. But what we're really trying to focus on is new development. Right now, our city and our valley is not a polluted attainment area. We're a non-attainment area. We don't have the air pollution the way that the Wasatch Front does. We want to maintain that. We want to maintain the non-attainment area. And so this ordinance is really focusing on new development. I know that there's probably some misconceptions, so can I just clear those up right now?
Sure.
This new air quality ordinance does not take away anyone's outdoor fire pits. It does not take away anyone's smokers that they want to use to, you know, make grill their meat and such. No, it's not taking away anything that anyone has right now. It's not going to force anyone to take away their wood-burning stove or anything like that, because what we have right now is still good for our air quality. But what it will do is focus on new development, new residential, commercial development, where there will be a wood-burning stove ban in new development only. So I'll repeat that. New development only. It doesn't take away anything that anyone has right now. So that's the strongest part of the air quality ordinance, that there will not be wood-burning stoves allowed in new development in our city, you know, from now on. And I think everyone can see that this will be a good thing, because we know on the Wasatch Front that the state government is buying up wood stoves out of people's home and replacing them with the cleaner burning natural gas. And they've done that for thousands of homes, and thousands of homes are still waiting on the Wasatch Front to change out their wood burning stoves.
Well, let me clarify that.
We're just trying to prevent that.
Yeah, let me clarify that. Is that just stove, wood burning stoves, or does that include wood burning fireplaces?
Both. Both. Now, we do allow in this new ordinance that if you want an EPA-certified wood-burning stove with the pellets, then that's perfectly fine. That's, of course, allowed, because those EPA wood-burning stoves have so much lower emissions than the regular open-burning fireplace or stove. So it's only for new construction, wood-burning stove ban. But if it's an EPA-certified stove or fireplace, then that is perfectly allowed.
Okay. What about vehicle emission testing? Was that considered?
It was considered. Council Member Stack was interested in it. We didn't feel like that it was going to get, it was going to really do much because of the Tier 3 gasolines that are now being sold in our city and will continue to be sold in more and more places. The Tier 3 gasolines really reduce car emissions up to 80%, which is fantastic. Also, we need to collaborate with the county on any vehicle emission standards, and that was just not approached with the county, so no, that is not a part of this air quality ordinance.
Okay, and what initiatives has the city agreed to take on?
Well, we're going to start a new slogan, I Care About Heber Air, and we're going to do the anti-idling signage. We're also going to do more on our website. We have set in place the new electric vehicle charging stations and standards as definitions for the wiring and all of that, so that we can negotiate for that in the new development, the new annexations, to have, you know, hopefully a lot more electric vehicle charging stations. We also want to negotiate in the annexations that are pending to put the electric vehicle outlets into the residential garages or the mixed-use parking garages. We have stronger standards for fugitive dust. We've lined up our code so that we can be very proactive when it comes to maintaining our air quality.
Okay, but in terms like the anti-idling and requiring radon air testing by property owners, I mean, who enforces this?
Well, it's not an enforcement. Again, the state legislature won't allow cities to require radon mitigation because it's not in the standard building code. So we would have to negotiate that in new development when it's a legislative decision in the zoning, you know, for annexation zone changes, new development. We could negotiate for that now. That's in our code that we may negotiate, but we can't require it because of how strict the state legislature is in changing zoning codes different than the established codes already.
Okay, but in terms of enforcing the anti-idling, you're going to have city police?
No, we don't have tickets. No, we don't have tickets. The police are not going to be out there watching to see, you know, if you're turning off your car. But we feel that with the signage and the educational outreach that our city will do, that it still can make a big difference.
All right. On other topics, council took public comment on the Sawmill development. This is located on Sawmill Boulevard, directly east of the Heber Valley a hospital. A three-story condominium building has been added to the plan that was apparently already agreed upon. Residents now say that this will ruin their view of open space in Mount Timpanogos. So can the plan be changed after the fact?
Oh, that's the big debate right now. This we held on Tuesday night the first of two public hearings on this change in sawmill development. The next public hearing that the public's invited to will be on August 10th, 6 p.m. for the Planning Commission. People can attend that online or in person to give public comment. So the crux of the matter, Leslie, is that the school district would like a school site in that 600-plus unit development. No one's really arguing about the school. The argument comes down to should the density, right? It's always density. Should the density remain the same with the school or not? Should the density be decreased because of the school coming in to, of course, have a 10-acre site there? And so it does come down to the original development was limiting it development to two stories, not the three, but two. And the new residents there don't want the three-story condominiums or apartments to replace the two-story single-family or townhomes that were originally proposed. I don't blame the new residents for wanting to maintain what they bought into and protecting their view shed. I had said at the Tuesday night meeting that I think the density should be decreased, but we only took public comment. There's still a lot of internal debate there between even developers and new residents on saying that they want to stick to the original plan. But the new, of course, the original developer would like to keep the same amount of density and build those higher three-story condos or apartments. And so no decisions have been made, and we would really like the public input.
All right. So do you think that the council will honor the school district's request to have a school site there?
We would like to get the school site there to prevent a lot of extra traffic going to other places or, outside of that subdivision. The Sawmill subdivision is a PCMU, a planned community mixed use. And so it was meant to be walkable, right? It was meant to keep as much as the density on site and being able to work and live and so forth and go to school right there. So we're glad that the school district wants the school site there. But I think the real debate will be how much density and how, you know, what that density will look like.
Okay, Heber City's suffering a huge engineering shortage. Bart Munford, who has apparently been with the city for more than 20 years, leaving at the end of September. Kathy Bingham, an engineering technician, leaving at the end of October. Tim Dixon, a staff engineer, leaving at the end of this week. So what do? Do you just have to hire an outside engineering firm to take care of the work?
I'm not sure about that yet, Leslie. Obviously, options are on the table. We've posted those positions, and we really look forward to getting qualified, great personnel to come in. That's our first plan. We will see how the application process goes, interview process goes. We do have another engineer on staff still, Russell Funk. He's been with us several years. He's done a tremendous job. So we're really going to rely on him. The positions are being advertised. We look forward to see who will come and help our city grow.
Yeah. Are they leaving then for greener pastures, better offers?
Oh, no, they're actually retiring. Two of them are. Kathy Bingham is officially retiring. Bart Mumford is officially retiring. I really don't know about their retirement plans, but obviously they have earned well-deserved rest with as fast as our city's grown. So I think Mr. Dixon has accepted another position that might be here locally, but you'll probably have to contact him about that.
Okay. City also proposing a property tax increase. A public hearing will be held next week. The increase of just under 10% equals to about $22 a year for residents, $40 for businesses based on a median-priced home and business of $430,000, I think. So given all of the new growth, why is a tax increase even needed?
Well, that was my question. I know I thought about proposing something like this a few years ago, but I'm looking at it from my perspective, Leslie. When I started on the city council back in 2014, we had a $6.3 million general fund. Now our general fund's up to $10.9 million 8 years later. That's nice growth. Our overall fund, with all of our internal service funds, water, sewer, capital projects, and all of that, is up to $38.2 million this year in our budget. So I feel like we do have the funding that we need. I know the rest of the city council is just concerned about trying to balance our revenue sources, and that's why they are proposing this property tax increase. So, you know, what are our revenue sources? We're getting 17% of that $10.9 million from property taxes. And this property tax that the rest of the council is proposing in total would only generate another $191,000. Now, I shouldn't say only, but that's still a lot of money, but that's still quite small compared to the $1.9 million that the city gets in total in property taxes right now. We're really reliant on sales tax. That's 41% of our overall budget. And we're really thankful that the Supreme Court allowed online sales tax to be gathered. Maybe you're not, but the city is very thankful because that's kept our sales tax growing tremendously, just tremendously over each year. We had a 16% in sales tax alone last year on the calendar year, not the fiscal year, and 8% the year before that and 12% the year before that. Those kinds of sales tax increases are really unheard of in most areas. We're thankful that we're getting it because that's the basis, right? That's the foundation for our current general fund. Now, the rest of the city council is saying, hey, we need to balance that. We need to have the stable property tax increase along with this more volatile sales tax increases to keep our city, you know, supposedly steady. The property tax increase meeting will be next Wednesday, 7 p.m., August 11th, online or in person. Let's see what the public says.
Okay. I know you need to leave. Do you have time to answer a quick question about the Community Reinvestment Act?
Yes.
An interlocal meeting is happening next week, and I've heard that Wasatch County Council is pretty lukewarm to this idea. How would their participation, though, make this more successful for Heber City?
Well, it will allow, of course, the tax increment financing to come, more of it, to come into the community reinvestment area. The biggest amount, though, is likely to be negotiated in the future with the school district, right? The school district gets so much of the property tax, the highest percentage, so the school district will be huge. But the county's part, that, you know, that 10% plus is still a big chunk of what a potential community reinvestment area budget. So Heber City did set up an agreement with ourselves to set up, you know, a baseline tax, and that for 20 years we will put, you know, the extra property taxes into the redevelopment area funding, which would go to affordable housing, subsidized rents for essential workers, you know, other parking goals, you know, trying to get downtown parking increase and things like that in this reinvestment area. We hope the county will see that that is important to them as well as to the city. I know that their goals, you know, are aligned that way. It's just what kind of term, how many years are they willing to give up the increased property taxes to go to this reinvestment area? And then how much are they willing to give up? What kind of baseline do they want? We'll discuss that with them again next Wednesday, 3 o'clock. City Council will be there with them.
All right. So are both the school district and fire district also being asked to contribute? They've already got tax dollars coming out from Mayflower, yeah?
Yes, it's big. You're right. We're not going to approach the fire district. We feel that their overall percentages are so small that it really wouldn't make a difference for the reinvestment area. But we will be going to the school district. And, of course, you can see how that could impact the sawmill development and trying to help them with the school district, you know, the school site there. So, you know, we're trying to collaborate so much more with the school district and the county than we have in the past, and I'm very glad for that. Hopefully this can be win-wins for everyone, but there's still plenty of debate.
Okay. Heidi Franco, Heber City Council member, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Well, the Summit County Council met yesterday, and on the phone there with a recap, County Council member Doug Clyde. Good morning, Doug.
Good morning, Leslie.
So the council began the meeting with a discussion of whether to combine the clerk and auditor positions. Did you decide to move forward with that plan?
Well, we decided to look into it fully to get an idea as to, you know, what the potential savings could be. excuse me, I'm slight cold here. So that's where we're at. We're a ways from any decision, but it is something that we need to look at because, first of all, state code allows us to do this, and majority of the counties in the state have already combined them.
Right. So who's putting forward this idea?
Frankly, I don't know precisely where the origin was. It just came up in budget discussions. Again, it's a common practice, and it's just up for us to evaluate it.
Right. And if implemented, it would be done for the 2022 election year, and there would be some cost savings. But I guess I'm just curious why combine? I mean, it seems like the clerk and auditor are two jobs that are quite different.
Well, and to some degree, that's the reason why you can combine them. And that may be a little bit counterintuitive, but, if you were talking about combining the auditor's office with some other financial function, then that would be a problem because we wouldn't have the oversight that we would otherwise have. But in this case, and that's the reason why clerk and auditors are commonly combined, is that it doesn't require that much management, and the functions of the office can be consolidated is, the general understanding.
If approved, it means that either Clerk Evelyn Furse or Auditor Michael Howard will be out of a job. So have you gotten their input?
Well, obviously, we're going to hear from them. This is not without some personal consequences for some individuals. Were it to move forward, but we're a long ways from that yet.
All right. The Highland Flats discussion, the developer's proposal is a general plan amendment to change the zone from rural residential to community commercial. If done, it would allow 410 multifamily and single family units on two lots, nearly 42 acres in size between Highland Estates and the Interstate 80 US 40 interchange. It did receive a negative recommendation from the Snyderville Planning Commission in March. The reception from County Council, Doug, seemed to be mixed. You said your major concern was that the project was not integrated. What do you mean by integration?
Right. Integration is one of the goals of our general plan, and we are very much in favor of workforce housing and encouraging as much workforce housing as we can. But to use my own phrase, we do not want to be involved in just simply warehousing employees. Our purpose in trying to incorporate affordable housing into our communities is to make sure that the people who work there are an integral part of our community. And this ranges everything from lift operators to fire personnel and members of the police force, and a whole bunch of other essential services. To make our county as much of a complete community as possible, we've decided that these functions need to be integrated. And that means simply that when you go into a development, it's not immediately clear that this is where the affordable housing is, that people are, that one door looks like another, et cetera.
Do you think that the project is compatible with Highland Estates, an older single-family neighborhood?
Well, I think that was that was one of their major challenges, is that they did not make any case that I could comprehend that indicated that they were compatible with the existing single family development. They're a very different type, very different density. Matter of fact, at one point they referred to their development as being secure and might have been tranquil was the word, meaning that they were set apart, I think was what they were trying to say.
So the major benefit being offered by the developers seems to be the affordable housing, and this is aimed right. at some 30 to 50% AMI, average median income. This is what the county's economic development director says is the most critical need for housing. But do we know if we need employee housing, given all of the projects in the works? We've got some units at Silver Creek Village. We've got the affordable housing at the Canyons. We've got Wileman. How much more right. is needed?
Right. Well, excuse me. Sorry. That's the million-dollar question. We we're trying to figure out how to get at a goal that is obtainable. I think intuitively we know that 100%. Of our affordable housing could not be captured reasonably within the county. excuse me, at least not under the affordable housing plans and regulations that we have currently. So we feel that we need to be selective in terms of the projects that we approve, and the projects that we approve are in the right place and doing the most that it can for the community. So we don't know the answer to that question. We don't have a hard number. We probably know that we reasonably can't get to 100%, but we need to marshal our resources and our land and make sure that we're doing the best we can with what we've got.
Now, the project could offer what's called a so-called waterfall provision. That means that it would give first preference to people who work here. Is that significant for you?
Right, and it that's a very complex function. But yes, normally our affordable housing requirements have preferential treatment. First they're available in some cases to county employees, then they're available to people who work in. Work in certain areas or work for, other government agencies or that type of occupation. Those are very important to us, to be sure. Did I miss the balance of the question?
Well, I guess I'm just wondering. I mean, is that given that? I mean, does that make it more attractable? I suppose to you.
In from a statistics point of view, the project is is very attractive. I think the statement that I made was that it's. It's simply it's A, in the wrong place, and B, it's not integrated. And those are two major elements of our general plan. And so those are big hurdles for them to overcome.
Okay, let's see. Traffic impacts. Their traffic analysis says that Highland Road could accommodate the additional traffic. Do you agree with that?
Oh, it probably can. Again, we don't think this has, I don't think, I polled my other council members on this. I don't think that the traffic impact is the issue. I mean, if you live over there, you certainly are going to be very acutely aware of it. Will they cause any of the intersections to fail? No, that's very unlikely. But that is very much an extraneous issue. I wish that we were down to the question of, gee, we could make this work if we just, improve the traffic flow. But that's not going to happen, I don't think.
Okay. Will the council plan a site visit there?
They may or may not. I don't know. It's a piece of property that I probably look at twice a day, so I'm not sure that I need to go walk it inch by inch, but yes, we may.
So what's next with this then?
They received our input. I think it was reasonably consistent. There may have been some other highlights that that other council members suggested. They've now got to go look at their plan and determine excuse me, whether they can respond to any of our any of our criticisms or desires. And so they, you know, there were issues also about energy consumption and energy plan was. And it also didn't seem terribly robust. And again, it's because they're attempting to do something very much on a shoestring. I appreciate what they were trying to do, but again, it just does not appear to be compatible with our goals on a whole variety of different levels.
Okay, let's see. Finally, the code amendments governing campgrounds and seasonal RV use was up for a public hearing last night. Chairman Glenn Wright said that they had more than 130 people online. About 25 people spoke during the public hearing. Back in May, Doug, you had said that areas like Manorlands had gone out of control over the years. And last night at the start of the meeting, you said that Manorlands was, quote, the poster child for subdivisions that can't police themselves. Most... Mm-hmm. But not all of the comments were critical of the proposed ordinance. And during a public hearing, you again heard from people from Manorlands and Uintahs saying that the county ordinance is a one-size-fits-all approach and is not the solution. And you again heard people say, let the HOAs work on settling the issue. So did you hear anything last night that would change your viewpoint on how this moves forward?
Well, this is, again, you know, this has been going on for years, and it's not just Manorland. It has to do with a bunch of different what we call cabin developments, which were unfortunate ideas that popped up probably in the 70s, in which people thought, well, I'll sell off my sheep grazing land for property that somebody can develop a cabin on. And they became fairly popular. There were lots of them done. Manorlands is one in which the probably the majority of the lots do not have anything built on them at this point. And they have generally been used essentially as private campgrounds. And that is entirely, you know, contrary to the zoning, if you will. They're zoned as single family, one to 80, agricultural based zoning, 1 to 80. And the uses are supposed to be residential there for built product. It's a very long-term problem. Manorlands happens to be one of the larger ones. They just happen to be one of the ones that have the most camping activity, if you will, that occurs on them. You know, we have reports of some sites having a dozen trailers on them, others that, you know, have four trailers on them year-round. All of those are not compatible with residential uses, and we just, we just need to enforce the concept of the code that these are residential properties and not private campgrounds.
Okay, because some speakers did say that the county council is showing a disdain for trailers, and I guess coming from a social equity base here, I mean, what's your response to that? I mean, is there this disdain for trailers?
Well, whether I like trailers or not is not the question. So a lot of those trailers up there are really nice pieces of equipment. People have hundreds of thousands of dollars invested in their trailers. This was not about whether you're staying in a trailer or not. This is about whether you're operating a campground next to a residence. They're just incompatible uses.
Yeah, and again, you say that these areas are residential neighborhoods, but residents say they don't receive any services from the county, so they are a recreation area. So what is it?
Well, and what do you mean by recreation? Recreation covers a broad spectrum, but it does not mean that you get to change the basic concept of a residential building being built on a piece of property versus changing that into a campground. You know, these were not, there's nothing remotely remotely logical or provable about the notion that they were permitted as campgrounds. It's just completely specious.
So what's your goal then when this comes back to council?
Well, the goal is to, again, you know, the criticism, among other things, is this is one size fits all. That certainly is true, but as a governing agency, we do a whole bunch of things that are one size fits all, right? We don't decide that some people can drift traffic lights and other people can't. We have a lot of rules that apply to everybody under every circumstance, regardless of what's going on. So, you know, we're certainly going to look at that, but the problem areas that we have, are being exacerbated by the sometimes peak and high use and unregulated use. It's mostly the unregulated use that is the problem of people putting several trailers on a small lot and potentially impacting water quality or their neighbors.
Okay, I need to leave it there. Doug, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Well, Summit County Library Director Dan Compton had a fairly brief discussion with the county council yesterday on extended access hours for the Colville Library. He joins me now in the phone, in the studio. He's sitting right in front of me. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning.
You did propose this hours extension last year, but then it got derailed by the pandemic.
That's correct. We were pretty much all ready to go with it, and then it was right before COVID hit, so we had to put it on hold.
Okay, so patrons basically need to come to the Colville Library. They would need to register to be able to come to the library off hours. So how do they do that?
Yeah, so they can just come in during normal business hours in Colville, which is 10 to 6 Monday through Friday or 10 to 2 on Saturday. Also, if they can't make it during that time, we are more than happy to schedule an appointment with them to talk about the program during a different time so that they can take advantage of these extended hours, which are 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. Monday through Friday, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Monday through Thursday, and then also 2 to 6 p.m. on Saturdays. So they'll be able to attend the library an extra 22 hours a week with this program.
Okay, and how do they get access to the library?
So with their library card, actually, we change their patron type so that it will allow them to scan their card and enter their PIN number on a little keypad outside the library, and then it opens the door for them during those off hours.
Okay. So you do background checks on people registering?
No, but there are security cameras installed throughout the whole facility now, and people also have to sign an agreement saying that they will follow our policies in order to use this program.
Okay, otherwise the card gets revoked for those extended hours?
Exactly. And yeah, so if anyone just tried to go up with their library card, it would not open the door for them. They'd have to be signed up for the program.
All right. And so how do you tell patrons then it's time to leave the library?
So there's actually a speaker system in the facility, and it makes announcements, and it lets them know that the library will be closing in 10 minutes or that the library is closed and that they need to exit the facility.
Okay, so will you have staff on shift to watch over?
Exactly. That's why we chose the hours we did, because we have staff at the Kimball Junction branch in the evenings and on those extra Saturday hours, so they can actually look at the security cameras, and they could also answer the phone. So if somebody has a question or they're having trouble checking something out using our self-checkout machines, they can call the Kimball Junction branch and get assistance, and that's why we selected those hours that we did initially.
Okay, so the staff will be at Kimball Junction as opposed to there in
Right, Greenville. Yeah, we only have 2.5 FTE at the Colville branch. And that's the whole purpose of this program, Leslie, is to give Colville residents more equitable access to library services. So we just don't have the staff to provide more hours, but this program is really groundbreaking. It lets people come in and pick up their holds when it might be more convenient for them, use our computers, use the Wi-Fi, have a comfortable space if they need to study. Great for teachers too. We're going to be reaching out to the North Summit schools to say, hey, if you've got a last minute book that you need for your class tomorrow and you just, you know, you need to get in and pick that up, you can come in if the library has already closed.
Okay, so it really is a social equity issue. I mean, were the folks in North Summit not getting the same kind of access to the library as those in Snyderville and South Summit?
Yeah, we do have longer hours in Snyderville Basin. We just have more of a demand here, more staff allocated here for that purpose, and we didn't have the ability to hire more staff at this time, so I tried to get creative and come up with this idea. We got a grant to fund it for the first 3 years, and we're thrilled with this possibility here, and we're going to use it as a pilot program, and maybe this type of service could be put in Camas or even at Kimball Junction. You know, it's just like our remote locker system in Hennifer. We're just trying to provide everybody with the most access possible so they can get their library materials and use our services.
So does the Camas branch have the same hours as Snyderville?
No, but they do have more than Colville, and they do have more staff. So that's why we chose Colville, and also just it's a smaller branch, so it was kind of just easier to try it there and set this up with the installation.
All right, so I guess you're not too worried, I guess, about somebody getting in there and creating havoc, or maybe even thinking they could spend the night?
No, and again, they have to sign up, and we're going to go through an orientation with them, and, you know, I guess if someone chose to do something crazy, it would be on camera, and then we could, you know, deal with that at that point, but it's no different than somebody coming in during our regular business hours and doing something crazy, I guess.
Okay, it's been in operation for a couple of weeks. How many people have you seen?
So far, we've registered 20 people. We just started it, so it's brand new, but we've also had about half of those people already take advantage of it and start using it, and some of them more than once. So I'm really excited about this and just trying to get the word out so more people can sign up.
Okay.
Even if you never use it, you know, it's an option if you ever do need it.
All right. What about just the library system in general? You reopened in early May. I mean, are we operating the same way we did before the pandemic?
For the most part, we've got some social distancing in place, like with our public computers, we're spreading people out a little bit more. We've been doing our children's programming outdoors this summer, having story times outside and in the local parks and things like that. So we've taken some measures to try to be safer, but otherwise you can come into the library just like you always used to be able to and study and pick up your materials, browse. That's the thing people miss the most, is being able to browse the collection, and so we're thrilled to have that back. And yeah, so for the most part, we're back to normal, but I know things are kind of up in the air right now with the way things are heading with COVID again, but we'll just follow the guidance from the health department and do whatever we can to provide the best service while still remaining safe.
Okay. Any other programs you've got going on you want to mention?
Just One Book, One Community. Ross Gay, The Book of Delights, is the selection, and he'll be speaking to the community in early October. And so we encourage everybody to pick up a copy of that book at the library or use our online or our digital resource, Libby, to check that out and read it. And we'll have some supporting events, book discussion, and some journaling workshops and things like that to support that program.
Okay, what's the book again?
It's called The Book of Delights by Ross Gay.
Okay. All right. Dan, thanks.
Thank you.
It's Dan Compton, Summit County Library Director. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW News Time Now, 8:53. Well, following last week's dump truck trash at Marsac Avenue and Deer Valley Roundabout, Park City government stepping up the enforcement of brake inspection rules on the road and exploring alternate routes into the city for truck drivers. KPCW's Sean Higgins has more.
Traffic was disrupted for an entire day last Wednesday after a dump truck descending Marsac Avenue crashed into the roundabout with Deer Valley Drive, struck two other vehicles, sent three people to the hospital, and downed power lines. The Utah Highway Patrol reports the truck's brakes failed while descending Marsac after the driver did not stop at the mandatory brake check area across from the Ontario Mine. Trucks weighing over 10,000 pounds are required to stop and inspect their brakes before descending Marsac into Park City. UHP is handling the investigation of the accident because SR-224 and Marsac fall under its jurisdiction. In response to the accident, Park City Police Captain Phil Kirk says the department has stepped up brake check enforcement efforts on the road. He says the checks are primarily educational, but repeat and egregious offenders will receive citations.
We're doing a lot of enforcement up on the mine road to make sure we don't have another, hopefully prevent another accident like we had with the truck going through the roundabout. So we're spending a lot of time up there, and myself included, doing enforcement and writing citations.
Large trucks also have the option to descend into Park City on Royal Street through Deer Valley. Deputy Park City Manager David Everett says the city is considering new restrictions on truck routes.
You can go up the Royal Street route for sure, but that comes with its own set of challenges. Some of the turns on that street are much tighter, and so it's not necessarily a better option, but we are evaluating whether in certain situations we should look at requiring trucks associated with construction to use that route.
Further complicating the issue is the city's ban on engine braking, also called Jake braking, where a driver releases compressed air in the engine through a truck's exhaust, causing a loud noise. The braking is banned in Park City to prevent noise pollution. However, engine braking is allowed to, quote, avoid imminent danger. Engine braking is also allowed on Royal Street, Erie Drive, and the Ontario Canyon area of State Route 224. Kirk adds the department is also considering altering the current signage on Marsac in order to make the road's regulations more obvious to truck drivers.
We're going to take a look at that and maybe try to make it more visible. Some of the drivers that I've contacted said that they, for whatever reason, did not see the sign. It's a pretty large sign. There's actually several of them there. But for whatever reason, they're saying they're not seeing the sign.
This most recent accident comes after two dump trucks also crashed in the Empire Pass area of Marsac late last summer. Utah Department of Transportation Representative Courtney Samuel says UDOT does not place restrictions for dump trucks on state routes and does not have any projects scheduled to reconfigure SR-224 and Empire Pass. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
The Quarterly Real Estate Report is made possible by the Park City Board of Realtors, providers of statistics and information about our local real estate market through the Park City MLS.
The 2022 Sundance Film Festival will require all in-person festival attendees to be vaccinated for COVID-19. KPCW's Michelle Dininger has more.
COVID-19 hit Park City early in 2020, right as 100,000 visitors were flying home from the Sundance Film Festival to points around the globe. In the weeks after the festival, Park City briefly had the highest per capita rate of COVID cases in the country. Sundance Film Festival organizers are planning for a healthier outcome next time around. Festival Director Tabitha Jackson announced this week that vaccines will be required for everyone attending the 2022 festival in any capacity. The next festival runs January 20th through the 30th. In a memo to the Sundance community, Jackson wrote that 2022 will be bigger than this year's hybrid festival, but still offer some hybrid elements. Masking policies and theater capacity will be determined closer to the festival's start date. Specifics around the festival's processes for confirming people's vaccine status will also be finalized in the coming months. The announcement comes as cases of COVID's Delta variant are surging in the country and hitting unvaccinated people the hardest. Increasing numbers of employers and institutions such as colleges are starting to implement vaccine requirements to curb the spread of the virus. Michelle Dininger, KPCW News.
And the much-looked-forward-to annual shopping spree for new accessories has been canceled. Peace House's long-standing fundraiser, the Bling Fling, is no longer. For 7 years, women and some men cleaned out their closets, dressers, and jewelry boxes and donated their unworn rings, purses, and scarves to Peace House for their annual holiday fundraiser, bling bling. According to Peace House Executive Director Kendra Wyckoff, this is the second year in a row that the event will be impacted by the pandemic, and given the tremendous amount of volunteer effort and time to put it on, it just made sense to end it.
This is the second year in a row where the event has been impacted by the pandemic, and it really is an event that requires an incredible amount of advanced planning, about 6 to 9 months to build the inventory and that incredible volunteer force. And, you know, the volunteers typically are working in close quarters, and just with the ongoing uncertainty of the public health crisis, it complicates the health and safety issues. So our organization, you know, is reflecting on the fact that the event is not happening in its original form, now going on 2 years. So we are reassessing what makes sense for our organization in terms of events in this current and our new normal going forward.
She says Bling Fling has raised more than $300,000 over the 7 years, money that directly supported victims of interpersonal violence. COVID-19 has not impacted just Bling Fling. The pandemic, she says, has been devastating for victims of domestic violence. They've seen a 50% increase in helpline calls since 2019. And just last month, the campus population was the highest it's ever been in Peace House history, housing 33 survivors, which includes both adults and children. Wyckoff hopes to make up that fundraising shortfall with their annual spring luncheon. For those looking to clean out their Bling Fling accessories, she suggests making donations to the Christian Center in St. Lawrence. Both of them partner with Peace House to support survivors of domestic violence by providing them vouchers so they can shop at the boutiques in Park City and Heber.